Hi, this is Paula Morrell, and welcome to the Tales from the South podcast.
Like the autumn leaves you've changed, and the winter winds blew in, and now I'm over you, and the winter winds blew in, and now I'm over you.
How's everybody doing tonight? So how about tonight's music by Brad Williams and Nick Devlin? Did y'all like Brad and Nick? Brad Williams and Nick Devlin, one half of Arkansas's Kings of Honky Tonk, the Salty Dogs, have been playing some songs tonight from the record the band is currently working on. They have CDs for sale after the show, and more can be heard at thesaltydogs.net. All right, well, welcome to Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, and to another edition of Tales from the South, where Southerners bring their own true stories to life. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, both right here in North Little Rock, Arkansas. And I'm your host, Paula Martin Morrell. On my right here, strumming his 1931 National Resonator, is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. Mark was the longtime sideman for bluesman John So Blue Weston, a house guitarist at Junior Kimbrough's Juke Joint, and is a veteran of many festivals nationwide. Mark wrote our theme music and plays for us live each week. And how about our set back here? Y'all like our set? Each week we feature an artist, and tonight's featured artist is Little Rock painter Christy Young. And our featured piece is this piece right over here entitled Happy Bike, which is for sale. Our listeners can find out more about this piece and Christy at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern style storytelling? Tonight, our stories are all centered around our writers keeping things amongst themselves, or not. All stories are true and told by the Southerners who lived them. Later tonight, Sandra Hamilton is haunted by what she didn't do, and will end the night with Tyler Thompson as he vows to keep an event under wraps. But let's start the night with Ann Owings Wilson and a purchase she'd just as well not tell others about in Dreamboat Part 2.
I see you got a boat, Mark said. Does it run? We were standing behind the house looking toward the barn. The boat was about halfway into the barn, but it was such a tight fit, I would never again try to park it there. Yes, we took it out on the lake. I finally have the title. Long story. Do you have time to help me put it in the water? Sure. Needs a little work, though, he said, stating the obvious. The boat was at least 30 years old and had not been mothballed in a garage. Pick out some vinyl fabric and I'll reupholster those cushions. I'll fix up the steering wheel and make us an awning. You can do upholstery? I asked. I shouldn't have been surprised. I had found over the years that there was very little he couldn't do. He was a master carpenter, an electrician, a plumber, a mechanic, and an all-around handy guy. Without him, I would have sold the place long ago. Used to have an upholstery business. Well, okay. Tell you what, you help me fix up this boat, keep it running, and we can share it. You can take it out anytime. All right. My son loves to water ski. We drove the boat down to Cove Lake for its maiden voyage. I managed to back it down the ramp, and Mark detached it from the trailer. We were ready to go. The engine started with a nice vroom, and we set off across the lake. It was great. The wind was in my hair. The water surged around. I had a feeling of freedom and power. As soon as I rigged up a yoke, I'd be water skiing. Or at least my grandchildren would. Halfway across the lake, the engine started to sputter. Uh-oh. We turned to go back, but it died completely within seconds. We were stranded in the middle of the lake. Luckily, there was an oar, so we paddled to shore. Mark examined the engine. There's oil leaking into the gasoline. That's not good. Can you fix it? I don't know that much about boat engines. Better take it to a marina. The nearest marina was in Russellville, more than an hour away. They agreed to look at it and get back to me. A week later, they gave me the verdict. The engine was shot. It would have to be rebuilt or replaced. I looked at that sad old boat and just couldn't see putting any more money into it. The marina people wouldn't accept it as a gift, so I paid them for their time, hitched up, and headed back toward the mountain. Just as I was entering Subiaco, I felt an ominous wobble. I pulled over to the side of the road and examined my car and the trailer. One of the trailer tires was flat. With a great deal of difficulty, I unhitched the trailer, leaving the boat by the side of the road. I was tempted just to abandon it, but the license would lead straight back to me. A garage in Subiaco sent a boy back with me to the boat. We hitched it up and drove on the flat tire very slowly on the verge of the road until we reached the garage. "What kind of tire do you want?" they asked. "You'll need two. The other one's just about shot." "Just give me one good enough to get me back up to Mount Magazine. Then I'll decide what to do." They installed an old tire, warned me it wouldn't go 100 miles, and refused any payment. I tipped the boy who had helped me. I made it back to Mount Magazine and backed the boat in behind the cold house. Then I could not get the trailer off the hitch. I tried and tried. My car seemed to be welded to the trailer. This was bad, very bad. If I needed to go to the store, I'd have to haul the boat with me. When I drove back to Little Rock, I'd have to find a parking space long enough for both the car and trailer. Wherever I went from then on, probably for the rest of my life, I'd have a broken down old boat I'd paid way too much for, wagging behind on trailer tires that were only good for a few more miles. I was about to cry when a neighbor drove past. I waved and he stopped. With his superior masculine strength and know-how, he was able to unhitch the trailer. Although I was grateful, this was just one more humiliation. Mark came by to hear the verdict. "I was afraid of that," he said. "These old boats, a lot of times the engine goes out." I didn't like having an inoperable boat parked behind my cold house. It was a reminder of my foolishness in buying it. I called several marinas and salvage yards, but no one would take it. It would stay there, probably forever, rotting away, keeping company with the carcass of the old Dodge sedan someone had abandoned 50 years ago in the woods just past my property line. Several years passed. The boat was still behind the cold house, still reminding me that my judgment, especially when impelled by desire and imagination, was far from infallible. Maybe this was a good lesson in humility, but does anyone actually like such lessons? I certainly don't. I figured I'd have to sell the house to get rid of it. One of the conditions of sale would be that the boat went with the house. Then Mark approached me with a proposition. His son had been studying engines and had become a pretty good mechanic. Mark thought he and Matthew would be able to rebuild the engine and get the boat running again. Then he could reupholster the cushions, fix it up generally, and have a pretty good boat. "That's a good idea," I said. "I'm inclined to say yes, but I have one condition. Yes, what is it? You can take that boat away, but whatever you do to it, however you fix it up, I never want to see it again.
Ann Owings Wilson publishes Arkansas Court Bulletin and plays mandolin with Arkansas Mandolin and Guitar Association. She was transplanted to the South at the age of 10 and is still unsure whether damn Yankee is one word or two. Next, Sandra spots Hamilton's salvation comes when she realizes it's just between her and her friend in Miss Melva Goes to Heaven.
The drive to Batesville would have been pleasant had I let it. Instead, I mentally beat myself up the whole way for not being a good friend to Glenn. I'd saved my money for the conference and prepaid, so it was set in stone. I alternately chastised and excused myself for not driving in the opposite direction to attend the funeral for Glenn's mother. Yes, he had said it was fine and we'd get together back in Little Rock afterwards, but the guilt hung over me like the overcast clouds I was driving toward. The whirlwind of conference activities kept me from thinking about the funeral and not being there when Glenn needed me, but then I tortured myself further on the drive home. He is your most loyal friend, I thought. Losing his mother was so sudden and he was blindsided. And where were you? A-W-O-L. Absent without loyalty, that's where. The goody-two-shoes angel hovering over my right shoulder was working overtime. I drove into town and straight to Glenn's apartment. I knocked and waved through the sliding glass door, mouthing, "Let me in." "Oh, thank God you didn't come to the funeral," he exclaimed as I shoved the white orchid into his hands. "The only thing that got me through is thinking about how awful you and I would have been together and how I wouldn't have dared to look at your face during the service." My stomach tightened with guilt. I knew how close Glenn was to his mother. So did something just terrible happen? Did somebody faint or have a heart attack? Well, my older sister Kay had gone up to the funeral home before I got there and gave Marydell an outfit for mother, slacks and her favorite blouse. You know, she always had blouses with breast pockets because she liked to go to the dog races, and that's where she kept her little betting book. An hour before the visitation, Marydell called Kay. She was really burned up because she had been trying to get her all day to tell her she forgot to bring mother a pair of panties. Well, who thinks of a thing like that at a time like this? Marydell just insisted that she couldn't let mother go that way. She said nobody should go to the gates of heaven without underwear, for goodness sakes. So I walked into the visitation while people were gathering and saw that mother looked beautiful, except that one breast was way higher than the other. I pulled Kay over to ask her what happened to mom's bust line, and then she told me what she had to do. It took her way too long to get to mother's apartment, find the panties, and get back there. When she finally made it, Marydell was nowhere in sight, and Kay had to find a place to put the panties so Marydell could redress her before the service. So what does my brilliant sister do? She folds them up and puts the panties in mother's dog notebook pocket. So Marydell would have them at least before the funeral. At this point, I was bursting to stifle my laughs. Glenn went on. I told her, "Kay, we can't have mother looking like that for the visitation, all lopsided and everything." So she'd wander over to the casket when no one was looking and try to ease the panties back out of the pocket. But then somebody would come up blubbering about our poor mom every time she'd get close. And then I'd try the same thing with no luck. So we had to leave mother as is and hope nobody looked too close into her pocket or, heaven forbid, said anything about her chest. "Oh my," was the only comment I could get out of my mouth between the stifled giggles. "Oh, get it out," he said. "We've got to laugh about it." And he continued, So seeing you and I together would have never made it through without cracking up for the wrong reasons and making a spectacle. He looked in my direction and we both burst forth with belly laughs, hanging on to each other as we laughed and cried all at the same time. We couldn't have even looked each other in the eye, but just thinking about you and me being there together, looking at Mother and that pocket, and how we couldn't have held it together from laughing got me through. Every time I wanted to cry, I thought about how inappropriate you and I would have been, and I felt a whole lot better. Well, I said, with my side still aching, glad I could be of service by not being anywhere in sight. Guess my absence has a healing effect on people. I was feeling a lot better about my decision by this time. But your mother, what would she have thought about all this? Oh, are you kidding? You know, she was never one for convention or pomp and circumstance. She would have loved it. In fact, I could swear I saw her pat that pocket and give me a little wink.
Sandra Spotts Hamilton, a native of Little Rock, works as a designer and writer. Like the women of Steel Magnolias, her favorite emotion is laughter through tears. She is grateful to have shared many of these moments with her friend, Glenn. In our final story of the night, Tyler Thompson vows silence with a handshake in My Fist and My Foe.
All names in this tale, except for my childhood nickname of Tommy, have been changed because, well, you know how high school was. It was 1964, and goodness knows, it was a whole different world than today, almost a half century ago. Time passes so quickly. "Stop, Tommy! You're gonna kill him!" I was beating the stuff out of Fred as hard as I could, sitting on his chest and pummeling his face. Stevie pulled at my shoulders, pleading for me to stop. But the harder he pulled, the fiercer I felt motivated to teach this bully a lesson. But Stevie got a hold of me from behind, locking his hands together across my chest, and dug his feet into the ground, flinging us backward and falling sideways beside the inert shape of Big Fred. Stevie and I just looked at each other, breathing heavily after the exertion we had just expended. Then we looked back at Fred, sprawled back on his back, with his messed up face, displaying blood matching that which was on his button-down yellow Oxford shirt. As we knelt beside him, I was glad that he was still breathing, though just barely. As a kid, I was called Tommy, and not very athletic. I'd be more like what you'd call artistic. Where many boys like to engage in rough and tumble activities, I tended to gravitate more toward board games, reading, and solving puzzles. Now, that's not to say I didn't enjoy sandlot baseball or engage in swimming and tennis. But when it came to intense body contact, that just wasn't me. It only took playing pickup football to realize that my body doesn't appreciate that abuse. Same thing with basketball. It was rougher than I ever imagined watching it played on the courts at school. It would not surprise you, probably, to learn that I excelled in the choir and band programs. It was much easier to stand beside the football field or basketball gym with the pep band supporting the team and screaming, "Hit 'em hard and kill 'em, team," just as long as I was not the one having to engage in the physical devastation that was necessary to win the games. My statement about avoiding physical contact might cause my parents to object here and remind me that I routinely got into fist fights with my younger brother in our early years. My parents got so tired of pulling us apart that they bought a set of boxing gloves and said that if they ever caught us fighting again without those gloves on, there would be hell to pay. We never fought again. Lesson learned. All through school, I remained artistic. By the ninth grade, I was 5 feet 11 inches, weighing 110 pounds. I was so skinny that if the wind blew on school mornings, I'd end up right back in the house trying to run out that front door again. My being artistic, tall, and skinny led to bullying, which at times became almost unbearable. I tried to block out the names I was called and avoided my locker often due to close quarter intimidation, but managed to effectively and eventually create in my mind a world where I not only survived, but thrived. Fortunately, I had a pretty good mind, and unlike a lot of my classmates, seemed to be able to remember the greatest part of what I had read, which came handy at test time. But it also led to bullies trying to mine my knowledge for their gain. I was told by them that I had to let them copy off me on multiple choice and true-false tests or else. Now you may say, well, why not just tell the teachers or the principal? Yeah, right, I've got to go to this school. On tests, I'd let them see over my shoulder or across the aisle. And after they saw what they wanted, I'd go back and change the crucial answers. Those guys never did figure out why I got A's and they got C's. I was no ladies' man, and I knew it. All I ever wanted was to just be friends with the guys and the girls. One girl I enjoyed knowing was in my Spanish class, who happened to be 2 years ahead of me and going steady with a Hulk on the football team, Big Fred. Now, Stacy didn't really care about making A's. She just wanted to graduate. She wasn't the brightest muchacha, and I would help her with her homework in the library during study hall. Fred's football teammates told him that this wimp of a whiz was sharing time with his honey. And in no time, he had me cornered, telling me that I'd better lay off my woman, or else. A few days later, she asked me why I had been avoiding her. I told her that I'd been busy on some projects I needed to finish. News of our talking got back to Fred, who again caught me in between classes and said it had hit the fan and that I had to meet him by the shack in the woods next to the school after school. Tommy, you know where I mean you to be, and you better be there. Next class period was banned, and I told Stevie how Big Fred was going to beat me up. I didn't know what to do. Stevie said that he'd go with me and hide behind a tree. I asked, how will that help? He said, well, when Fred is through with you, I'll call the ambulance. In the woods with Stevie behind an oak, I faced Big Fred when he showed up. Well, Tommy, you've been flirting with my girl. Gonna have to teach you a lesson about messing with my squeeze. Then he came at me and grabbed me by the shirt, twisted it, and lifted me somewhat off the ground. At that moment, I raised my right leg as high as I could and brought the heel of my hard-soled shoe swiftly and angrily down and onto the back of his knee. He let out a whelp and let me loose. Hitting the ground, I extended my arms in front of me, clasping my fists together, and swung my body in a half circle to the left and thrust my fists into his belly. He fell backwards, hitting the ground with this overwhelming whomp, which I figured later knocked the breath out of him. All I knew was that he was down and vulnerable. I jumped on his chest and started beating his face with my fists, right and left, right and left. Stevie hollered, Tommy, stop, you're gonna kill him. Finally, Stevie snapped me out of it and pulled me off Fred. Stevie and I just sat there for what seemed like an eternity before Big Fred finally came around and lifted himself up onto his elbows. Dazed, he looked around tentatively and blew his nose, seeing more red join that which was already on his Oxford shirt. He finally said, who would ever believe that some beanpole of a pansy like you would ever get the upper hand on me? I didn't say a word, neither did Stevie. Big Fred stood up. I followed suit. Stevie remained on his ankles. Big Fred, after wiping his face with his shirt tails, said, whatever happened, happened. And not a word about it will ever be spoken. Understand? Because I could take you out right now and you'd be hamburger. You just got the drop on me because I never thought you'd fight back. I'm impressed that you tried, but you know that you'd lose if I came at you. I just looked at him. I knew it was this close to leaving this earth. But after some uncomfortable seconds, I simply stuck out my hand for him to shake. After some tremulous moments, he extended his and we shook. He held my hand for a few seconds and said, "Boy, if you're going to shake hands, you better do it more firmly than that, or you're going to make an absolute fool of yourself." And he proceeded to give me a lesson in such before leaving Stevie and me, intimidating us into silence. When Stevie's father was soon transferred to another city, Big Fred had one less witness to fret over. Interestingly, for the remainder of the school year, I experienced almost no bullying. Coincidentally, Big Fred would stop me in the halls at times and ask me if anyone was bothering me. I'd say no. Then he'd just nod and walk off. Big Fred graduated at the end of my sophomore year and joined the Army. I really enjoyed my junior and senior years. I even became an Eagle Scout and was named valedictorian by class. I also remember upon receiving my diploma, the superintendent commenting upon my impressive handshake. After graduation ceremonies, I noticed that one of the people waiting to shake my hand was Big Fred, home on leave. He said, "Sometimes we make mistakes. Allow yourself the opportunity to say, 'I'm sorry,' when you get it wrong. I'm very proud of you." He and I both grew in ways we had never expected to. Granted, things don't always work out for the best. But for me, this time it did. Isn't life a puzzle?
Dr. Tyler Thompson has authored 2 books about university bands in Arkansas and co-authored 3 other books regarding religion. Additionally, for 30 years, he has edited and published a national professional contact lens journal for fellow eye doctors. In his writing, Thompson says he always tries to elicit the comment, "I didn't know that," resulting in golden aha moments. So how about our stories and storytellers tonight? Thank you to all of our writers, thank you to our live audience, and thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and our official media sponsor is AY Magazine, Arkansas's leading lifestyle publication at aymag.com. Additional support provided by William F. Lehman Public Library, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, the Writers Colony at Derry Hollow, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, YouTube, and Stitcher Smart Radio, and you can download and listen to our podcast on our website. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
Woman lived this morning. She took a freight to San Antonio. She bought a one-way ticket, and I can say she's long gone. And writing her a letter from an address I don't know, she's moved on to bigger and better things. At least that's what I was told. Shows playing on my TV. No more whining, no more crying. More room to sleep in the bed. It was a long time coming. I'm glad she left me when she did. I'll admit we had our good times, and I'll admit we had our bad. I missed all of you. I'll miss your new best man. So when this letter finds you and you got the best of me. I'll just raise my glass and then I'll sing. Thanks for the memory.
Writer accommodations provided by Robinwood Bed and Breakfast. More at robinwoodbnb.com. Experience tales in person as a member of our live audience. Schedule and ticket information can be found at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern style storytelling alive. And we'll see you next week, either on this station or at Starving Artist Cafe, for another edition of Tales from the South.